Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your domineering stage mother of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I'll go whenever you press play, pause whenever you want, babe. Do whatever you want, babe. I'll sing whatever you want, babe. Make love whenever you want to. Do whatever we gon' do. No one's here but us two, me and you. The boy got so much dirt on me. Where if he was the sex police, thicker like a bitch up for the century.
Ayo. Been waiting months to do this. Ayo Scott in the building. You have just heard a little ditty called Private Property.
Yeah.
By a rising star named Noni.
Noni is on fire. Noni is as hot as they get.
Peak Fuego. Noni, as you may know, is the central character in a film called Beyond the Lights.
Which... I hope I know, since I did review the movie in our own newspaper. That's basic information for a critic to know.
Only the finest in expertise we offer you on the New York Times podcast. Beyond the Lights has been in theaters about a couple weeks.
Yeah.
A.O. Scott reviewed the movie from the New York Times. Tell us a little bit about what you thought about the movie.
I thought it was really wonderful. It's directed by Gina Prince Bythewood, who made a somewhat similar movie, I guess about 12 or 13 years ago, called Love and Basketball.
Very, very good film.
A great kind of pop romantic melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
And Beyond the Lights is very much that. I mean, it's kind of a backstage musical. It's about this Noni, who's a rising star in the world of hip-hop and R&B and pop music, a sexy chanteuse,
a
very Rihanna figure, who starts out doing these sort of sexy, sultry cameos in rap videos and on hip-hop albums, and is about to break through and release her own album and become, you know, and blow up big. And there's a lot going on in this young woman's life. She has the domineering stage mother from hell, played by Minnie Driver, who is just fantastic. So evil, so scary, and there's a little scene at the beginning that kind of explains it all. She was a poor single mother, white woman in Britain with a biracial baby, and she was determined to make it to the top using her daughter's singing talent. So she absolutely controls every aspect of Noni's career, and this has driven the poor young woman to the point where she tries to throw herself off a balcony of a hotel in Los Angeles.
After her big night. After the Billboard Awards.
She locks herself in her room, and one of the LAPD officers who's on security detail, a guy named Kaz, who has his own interesting family backstory,
mm-hmm.
rescues her and pulls her up onto the balcony, giving us the first taste of many tastes of his extraordinary muscles and upper body strength.
I would almost think that his physique should have gotten billed above him.
His physique is really one of the things that is definitely featured. There's a whole segment where they go off to Mexico together so that there can be 20 minutes in the movie where he just doesn't wear a shirt at all. That's potent stuff. But so then this kind of romance, a sort of the bodyguard type romance, mm-hmm. develops between them. There are various twists and turns that I won't divulge, but you're definitely in a kind of classic old Hollywood melodramatic territory in a way. I mean, you're
it
a
is
little
very
bit
old.
It feels almost like another version of A Star Is Born, you know, the 50th or 60th or wherever we're at. But it also is very contemporary and very knowing, I think, about the world of contemporary popular music.
I totally agree, but I think, and this is something that you really underscored in your review, there is something very traditional, almost conservative, about the shape of this love story. It's modern in its milieu, right. But it does not feel modern in its structure.
Not at all, because what happens is to get to the top, to get to where she is, Noni has had to sell herself out or been sold out,
yes.
By her mother, by the record label, by this ridiculous British rapper named Kid Culprit, who she's attached to.
Shouts to Machine Gun Kelly, though. Really just delivering all the bad villainy he could get into
amazing,
like 10 minutes.
Amazing. Just the most cretinous white rapper we've seen in a very, very long time.
Even Eminem's looking at this being like, ooh. There, but for the grace of God,
Vanilla Ice is feeling a little vindicated at this point. But anyway, she has to rediscover her authentic self and her authentic musical gift. She wants to write her own song. The musical thread that goes through the movie is Nina Simone's song Blackbird. The movie was originally supposed to be called Blackbird, which is a very beautiful, very harsh song about invisibility and loneliness and isolation with all kinds of very interesting racial and sexual connotations. And that's kind of Noni's secret theme song, and she somehow has to get back to the place where she can sing that to find out who she really is. And that means throwing away a lot of the trappings of fame and glamour and celebrity, and also undoing the way that she's been sexualized by the music industry.
And then there is, to jump ahead a little bit, there is the segment in the film where she and Kaz run off to Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is this actual very literal undoing.
Yes.
She takes out, you see the weave tracks.
Yep.
She takes out the purple hair extensions.
Yep.
She goes back to natural. Look, anyone who says that Hollywood magic does not exist anymore has not seen Rihanna turn into Corinne Bailey Ray in 90 minutes flat.
Right.
So there is Hollywood magic. It is
right.
Possible.
And there's a very interesting, because where you think it's going and the sort of the most conservative direction that it could go, where a movie, an old movie like a showbiz movie like The Red Shoes, say, would go, you think you're being set up that she's going to have to choose between love and her career,
mm-hmm.
between stardom and this man in her life. And the thing that is so brilliant about Gina Prince Bythewood's sort of revision of that narrative is that it flips it around. So he's actually the one,
yes.
who has to make the choice, because he has – his father is played by Danny Glover, is a captain in the LAPD who's been grooming him for a political career.
Sort of a sour
yeah,
character.
Well, he's sort of – kind of – because he's, I think, embittered by – as Noni's mother is – by his own
limitation.
Inability,
yeah.
his own inability to rise. And he wants – his son's going to be – the next Obama. And the whole plan is he's going to serve on the police force, and then there's an open city council seat that he's going to run for, and he's getting all of the ministers in the community lined up to endorse him. And then he's messing around with this hip-hop diva, which throws a monkey wrench in his dad's plan. So he's the one equally and ultimately who have to make the choice. The other thing I think is so interesting about this movie, and one of the reasons that I kind of have kept thinking about it and like it more and more, is that it does not simply reject pop stardom.
No, it doesn't, although this is probably where I found the flaws in the movie, and that it does seem to me that there is – it does posit this kind of diametric opposition between Noni the product,
yes.
and Noni the authentic
right.
self.
Right.
And I do think in 2014 – the product is the authentic self often enough. I don't know if
you
Rihanna...
You are so postmodern, man.
That's what I'm out here to do. That's what I get salary for. I don't think Rihanna has a box of lyrics underneath her bed. I think Rihanna is doing the exact thing that Rihanna wants to do, even if we would perceive of it in an old-fashioned way as less authentic.
Well, I think you make a point, and I think that's what you mean by, and I agree with you, by the conservatism of,
yes.
of the movie. And also that it assumes that the kind of sexual display that Noni is involved in at the beginning
is not of her own making.
Is not of her own making, and that she can only be a victim of that.
Yes.
And I think there are plenty of examples in the pop music world that call that equation into question. I mean, you think of someone like Nicki Minaj,
mm-hmm.
Does not seem to be especially victimized, and certainly does not play the role of a toy of male fantasy.
And look, you could talk about structures of power and all this other stuff that create circumstances where people who embody those stereotypes are actually just repeating them and they don't know what they're doing. You can do all that. But on a bottom line, I think in 2014 it is possible to be sex positive, to be authentic, quote unquote.
Yes.
It's possible to be a pop star who's interesting. That's why I sort of made the joke about Rihanna versus Corinne Bailey Ray,
because
it's like – to me, the actual victory is if she sort of stays Noni-like and still gets the guy, and the guy makes his choice. That's actually possibly a more modern victory than I had to strip away all these trappings. It may work less for the film.
Yeah, I think with the way that the film works, which I think is actually very beautiful, and maybe I sentimental and in some ways old-fashioned, is that the discovery that the people will love you anyway, that there is an authentic connection between pop stars and fans And this is very – you know, in the real world, this is a highly questionable thing. But as a dramatic structure, I think it's a quite beautiful idea that the fans will see the real you.
Even through, you can
throw all that away, and they will connect to you, and recognition is the key thing. The thing that Kaz, the Nate Parker, says, you know, that gets her to decide to live when she's trying to jump off mm-hmm. the balcony. He says, "I see you," right? So because she feels so invisible, she feels like her real self has been completely obliterated by this persona that she's been forced to play. At the end of the movie, she has a reunion with him, but also with her fans at this music festival. Like the last shot of the movie, they kiss, and then she goes out and crowd surfs. Yes. And like they see her too, and they love her for who she really is.
And literally embrace, not just figuratively right, embrace, right. literally embrace her.
And that's a very, I mean, that's a lovely and probably, you know, in the real world, dubious idea of celebrities. And I mean, it removes all of the predatory and exploitative energy from that comes up from the fans and just really assumes that it's only love going that way, that there's this sort of, you know, there's industry and there's cynicism and there's the bad mother that are poisoning it all.
But the fans are the ones who can actually – all right, let's take a moment and listen to – let's talk about that persona, the Noni persona. Let's listen to a bit of Masterpiece, which is Noni featuring Kid Culprit. Now work it, girl, don't close them curtains. Let these people see it, make it clap and repeat it. Say I'm a masterpiece, call me Master B, 'cause there ain't no limits, hey, when I make that body say, oh. Okay, so that was one of the songs yeah. in the film that's attributed to Noni. A thing that I learned by watching the credits is The Dream mm-hmm. wrote this song, along with maybe one or two other of yeah. the no, quote-unquote Noni songs.
Yeah.
Not 100% clear who sings this song.
I don't know if it's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who's the actress. Who's, mm-hmm. By the way, it's just sort of having a breakout year. She was in this movie Belle. Which was very different kind of movie. Terrific in that. Yeah, I don't know. It would be amazing if she actually had that voice.
Right, but my feeling is it's not, because at least how the album is credited on iTunes and Amazon, it's credited to Noni, the character, where there are other songs that are credited to the actress. Actually, it was funny because I hadn't totally realized this soundtrack was available, and I made a joke on Twitter. I was like, oh, waiting on that surprise Noni private property drop. And someone wrote back to me. They're like, it's on Spotify, though. And I thought they were messing with me. And then I went and looked, and I was like, oh, what do you know? There it is.
Yeah.
There are these songs, which I thought were – I won't say 100% accurate to today's pop charts, but kind of amplified some of the worst elements of mainstream, kind of like pop R&B, mm-hmm. hip-hop, mm-hmm. And put them on Noni somewhat unfairly, probably.
Yeah.
But they did amplify kind of some of the worst
right.
bits. But it was striking to me because the music feels very modern. And you talked a little bit about The Bodyguard before, and that was something that I never totally made sense with me with The Bodyguard. Mm-hmm. Some of that music just did not
right,
feel
right.
of that moment.
Right.
It felt very antiquated.
Yeah. No, and I think that this one, it's clear that the movie's – and I think they thought about this a lot as they were making the movie, that its credibility with a lot of its audience mm-hmm. would stand or fall by the music. At least, you know, right, it didn't have to be – the best or the most authentic or the most accurate, but you had to believe. You really have to believe.
It has to be someone who looks yes, like they could yes, be on the pop yes, charts right
yeah.
now.
Just as, I mean, it's almost like you had to believe in Inside Llewyn Davis, you know, that mm-hmm. these people were actual folk musicians in that bygone moment. And so I think they took a lot of care. And there's slight exaggerations. I mean, you know, Kid Culprit is a little bit much, but not that much.
Yeah, I mean, he's an SNL sketch is what he
yeah,
is, but it's
right.
close. It's you know, there are people like, and frankly, the rapper who plays him, Machine Gun Kelly, is like not, I mean, look, I saw Machine Gun Kelly perform on TV at the AVN Awards.
Yeah.
Like that's, it's like, it's not that crazy that guy would be out there acting like that.
And the sort of the, you know, the sleazy magazine covers that you see that she has all over her house where she's like getting spanked with a ruler. That's all, you know, totally
Though I have to say, the one of the only notes that struck genuinely false to me is one of those magazine covers is of Wax Poetics magazine, best I can tell. Wax Poetics is like a small, like almost like scholarly journal of like funk and soul. It's like a very, it's a very like Crate Digger magazine. And so the idea that Noni would be all like on the cover of Wax Poetics was really hilarious to me. Now, that said, there's almost no rap magazines or R&B magazines left, so like maybe that's just what you end up with when you're looking for magazines. But that definitely, I definitely wrote that down on my phone. I was like, Wax Poetics, question mark. Let's talk a little bit about soundtracks, because I think this actually came up in another piece that I worked on recently where I was interviewing Questlove and Chris Rock, talking about the soundtrack of Top 5, which is their movie, which is like maybe not as great as it should be soundtrack-wise, but there are a couple of funny moments and a couple of really apt moments. But when you think about sort of especially black film soundtracks of the 70s and black film soundtracks of the early 90s, these were things that almost really went tight hand in hand with the film, both in terms of the quality in the music, the relationship and of the music to the film itself, the amount of money that was spent on the record label side, like all these things were happening. Now, if you're not the Hunger Games, maybe you don't get a soundtrack.
Well, you tell me about, I mean, that I think has to do probably with the music business and where the profit centers.
I think it certainly has to do with the music business. I think it has to do with budgets, you know, the shrinking budgets, generally speaking. Yeah. I think it doesn't make sense to spend $1 million on a soundtrack. Certainly not when albums are being made for less, films are being made for less, like when everything's being made for less. An interesting example, an exception rather, is you look at what Mary J. Blige did with Think Like a Man 2, where they were just like, it's your album.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be loosely about the film, but it's a Mary J. Blige album. In a weird way, that's probably cheaper than licensing a bunch of songs or licensing songs
for no good purpose. Because, I mean, when you had CDs, you know, you could license old songs and put them on the CDs. But now, I mean, people have those songs. Like, to pay all that money to re-release, you know, things that have already been hits, doesn't seem to make a lot of market sense. So if you have one or two new songs that you can hope to get a lot of downloads off of, I think you're probably right that the soundtrack album, which is just a glorious musical genre in its own right with a great history, is probably, you know, sort of limping on its last legs at this point.
And that's why I thought it was interesting that the soundtrack for this album had this mix of character songs and then atmosphere, like songs that were played, and really songs that are not that famous, which there are a couple songs I think soundtrack, maybe a couple of love scenes that I was not completely familiar with, and maybe they had appeared on some EP at some point, but it's not something that I knew. You don't have a lot of sort of big money. You don't get the sense that they spent $100,000 to license mega famous songs on this.
And maybe this is the model. I mean, maybe this is the model that, you know, it's the same as Once and as Inside Llewyn Davis. You know, the way you do it is you make a movie about characters who are musicians, and you have the characters perform songs, and you hope that the songs are good enough and the performances are good enough to generate interest in their own right.
Right. And what's cheaper than a songwriter? You can certainly hire some songwriters, pay them a pittance. You can pay them the movie tickets.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about Gina Prince Bythewood and in terms of her career? Because she's someone who has made now maybe three seemingly very solid films
she's
within a particular milieu, but maybe has not broken widely from there.
Yeah, I mean, she directed Secret Life of Bees, which was not, I didn't love the movie, but it was a pretty good adaptation of a popular bestseller. And I feel like in the early 2000s, when there was a kind of another flowering of black romantic comedies and romances, and Love and Basketball was definitely one of the best of those. And then she also did for HBO an adaptation of a Terry McMillan novel with Sana Latham and Wesley Snipes, which is really, really good.
I have not seen, but
Disappearing
I want
to
see
Acts. It. Yeah. It used to show up on HBO a lot, and
it's probably on HBO
it's
Go.
You could probably find it. It's just really good, and all of these movies, this one too, and she's done a lot of TV work as well, but are crowd pleasers, you know, give you all of the sort of the romance and the drama and the hunky shirtless male characters mm-hmm. and the gorgeous and sympathetic female characters that that you could want. I mean, they have a real populism in them, and they also are very shrewd about gender, about class, about the professional lives and ambitions of their characters. In Love and Basketball was about, you know, that both of the characters were ambitious basketball players. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, then they're trying to negotiate their own ambitions and their attraction to each other and sort of figure out who they are to each other. And I think Beyond the Lights, what is remarkable about it is how easy it goes down and how complex what it's trying to do really is. Like mm-hmm. it's because it's trying, you know, it's a backstage movie. It's a family drama. It's a story about a career woman in a professional crisis. And it's a, you know, a smoking hot love story. Right. And also it has, as you were right to point out, very sort of like solid and conservative values at the heart mm-hmm. of it. And it's very sort of scrupulous about those. It is, you know, gonna at the end of the day present a positive and constructive message right. about men and women and love and music.
It's also, I think, slightly complicated about race and belonging.
Yeah.
I think an interesting thing that I don't know if the film does this deliberately or if it does this not deliberately, but when Noni is sort of at her peak in the Noni character, she plays the Billboard Awards or the Billboard Awards yeah. and the BET
yeah.
Awards.
Yeah.
And so she's at the BET Awards and there's a predominantly black audience, but she's still Noni. When she sort of relieves herself of the Noni character mm-hmm. and sort of breaks things down to her allegedly authentic self, she plays this festival and all the crowd shots of that festival are like pretty white.
Yeah.
And I was surprised. Like, I didn't know if it was meant to be a Glastonbury type thing. Like, I wasn't sure what the reference was supposed to be, but it made me wonder if that was a deliberate choice about which part of oneself you present to different audiences.
That's very interesting because there's another a thread that's connected to that is the movie starts in South London, you know,
yes.
in a very sort of working class,
it's in
multicultural
yeah.
right. British milieu, mm-hmm. you know, and the first scene is Noni's mom taking her to for emergency hair care because she's mm-hmm. a white woman who doesn't know how to do a black girl's hair for this
right.
talent show,
right.
Which Noni gets second place in, you know, for obviously racist reasons.
Right, right.
And her mother doesn't, you know, smashes the trophy and says that's not good enough. But and then there's a really fast cut and all of a sudden that was like 1998 South London, you know, Brixton, sort of this sort of rough red brick place. And then all of a sudden you're not only in the present, but you're in LA and you're in the sort of like, yes, fantasy world, L.A. So
you're in black celebrity L.A.,
yeah,
which is like a
yeah.
very specific.
And then she goes home to the festival is also in London. So there is a transatlantic.
Sure, sure. Interesting.
And there's also the fact that she's biracial, that she's a poor English girl and also a black woman
mm-hmm.
In America. And there, you know, there's a lot layered through that.
It reminded me a little bit of, I mean, and this may just speak to the fact that there are so few people working in this kind of space, but
yeah.
like when I think about Mara Brock Akil, who makes all these television, who makes especially The Game about basically black celebrity culture,
yeah.
and I'm always very impressed by like the attention to detail with the back, you know, whether it's the type of clothes that mm-hmm. that are being worn or like the rhythm with which those interviews in the movie are done in this movie,
yeah.
where it's like they're just cycling in like sycophant after sycophant
yeah.
for 10-minute bumps.
Yeah.
That all feels very real to me. And it's always reassuring to me that people are paying attention and like accurately documenting and dramatizing this sort of environment.
Right.
But then it also makes you realize, well, how few people are actually paying attention if it's only just this one filmmaker, this one television show maker.
Yeah, no, that's really true. And there is a way that this movie felt so fresh and exciting because it did seem to recognizably represent a world of pop culture and also a larger cultural world that we all know about. But movies just can't, you know, that they shy away from or they falsify or they just never kind of bother mm-hmm. or very, very rarely sort of bother to say, well, what would this – be like. I think that's true even – obviously, the movie is full of dramatic exaggeration and melodrama, but just even the way that – the way it represents the male character too, Kaz, you know.
Yeah, we barely talked about Kaz.
Who is a striver. You know, he has all these like self-help books and he collects inspirational quotes. And there's something so earnest and so kind of dead on about that. And he has a plan. He has a mission. And it's been instilled in him by his father and by the people around him that, you know, you're going to be a leader. You're going to be a role model. You're going to walk the straight and narrow. And
he's got the Obama book on the shelf.
And
the New York Times Obama
and you
book.
Realize that puts enormous pressure on him. I mean, you have it's symmetrical with what's happening with Noni, who has this pressure coming from her mother to be this sort of sex pot bombshell so that she can secure all of the, you know, all of the money and security and fame that her mother feels like is their
is
due.
Rightly theirs.
And Kaz is getting the same thing from his dad and is finding it similarly constraining and in a way similarly inauthentic.
That's the triggering moment for the end of the movie is Kaz's recognition that he is as much a pawn as Noni has been. And while he's been trying to be the guy who's like, I see you, I see you.
Right.
He wasn't seeing himself.
He wasn't seeing himself. And he does the Goodwill Hunting thing, speaking of movies that Minnie Driver is in. He's like, he throws it all away and goes to see the girl. Mm-hmm. And which is, you know, a beautiful romantic fantasy in its own right. And an interesting sort of like – there's a sort of romantic feminism right in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
– this guy would give
the
up.
The man would love you so much.
He'd just give it all up.
He could – you know, city council seat.
It's nothing.
It's no need.
It's nothing. It's light work. It's light work to walk away from that. Well, I'm glad that we have gotten back to our authentic selves, you and I. Let's listen to Noni as we're getting back to her authentic self as we go out today. Let's hear Blackbird by Noni.
Oh, Blackbird. Oh, Blackbird. Now I rise as the phoenix escapes from me through the fire, through the flames, leaving the ashes underneath.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Our guest has been A.O. Scott.
Very nice to be here, John. Thank you.
Read what A.O. Scott has to say about Beyond the Lights on nytimes.com/music/movies. Check out our Spotify playlist, which does not include Taylor Swift. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we will be back next week.